So this is page 84 in the old edition and page 95 in the new edition, more or less, 92 in the new edition. So Vladimir has moved in an interesting way from the mythic and mythological towards the rational at the end of his presentation. And in this presentation, we're moving from the rational towards the supra-rational or mystical, necessarily, in philosophy, we have to do both of these things. We have to move in both of these directions. So last time we were speaking about consciousness, answering the question, what is consciousness? And the next question that we will need to ask is, do we need, for an understanding of evolution, anything more? Do we need any other understanding than the understanding of what is consciousness? In order to get to that question, I would like us to go back and do a little bit more careful reading of Sri Aurobindo. This is the chapter called Conscious Force. And I think that in addition to the one called Man and the Evolution, this is the other one which is most pertinent to this whole course as it has unfolded from Darwin through all the various discussions that we've had of evolution. Conscious Force is the name of the chapter. It's in the early Life Divine, right at the beginning, whereas Man and the Evolution is in the New Life Divine, which was written 20 years later. And last week, we were reading a section from that chapter, Man and the Evolution, which was very Darwinian. It was about the transition from the anthropoid pre-human to the human, and the evolution of the human with respect to the mind in particular, very much along the lines of Lawrence's work. So we'll refresh that a little bit tonight, but to go back to this question, what is consciousness? And we defined it last week very much in terms of cognition. Cognition means the ability of a creature to respond intelligently to its environment. And so there is evidence of cognitive behavior in all animal species. All animal species have structures, nervous system structures, which predispose them to a certain range of behaviors, such as depth awareness, spatial depth awareness, light and heat awareness, smell, discriminatory smell, constancy perception, which enables the most primitive animal to orientate itself to its environment and to move towards light or away from heat. This is cognitive behavior. in its most basic form. And then at a slightly higher form, in higher animals, Lawrence points out many behaviors that are very typical of human behaviors. Imitation, exploration, play, ritual enactment for the purpose of informing other members of the species, ritual enactment, symbolic enactments of possibilities which are not actually being pursued for their original purposes. For example, fighting behavior in its ritualized form instead of actual fighting behavior. So, looking at this notion of consciousness as opposed to the first suggestion we had, which was that consciousness means mental awareness, rational thought. We came to this understanding that consciousness actually means much more than that. So I would like us to look at Sri Aurobindo a bit closely here in this regard. Having established the point in this chapter, conscious force, that force is one thing that we all agree upon is a reality of the universe. Energy, movement. He proceeds to ask the question about consciousness. It is then necessary to examine into the relation between force and consciousness. But what do we mean by the latter term? We will see that throughout the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo pursues an evolutionary line of thinking and a mystical and metaphysical line of thinking, both, throughout. He says, ordinarily we mean by it our first obvious idea of a mental waking consciousness, such as is possessed by the human being during the major part of his bodily existence. When he is not asleep, stunned, or otherwise deprived of his physical and superficial methods of sensation. So, sensation and perception give us awareness. And that is the conventional definition of consciousness. In this sense, it is plain enough that consciousness is the exception and not the rule in the order of the material universe. We ourselves do not always possess it. But this vulgar and shallow idea of the nature of consciousness, though it still colors our ordinary thought and associations, must now definitely disappear out of philosophical thinking. This idea that consciousness is what we experience in our waking mental state, that idea is shallow and expendable. So then what is it if it's not that? For we know that there is something in us which is conscious when we sleep, when we are stunned or drugged or in a swoon, in all apparently unconscious states of our physical being. Not only so, but we may now be sure that the old thinkers were right when they declared that even in our waking state, what we call then our consciousness is only a small selection from our entire conscious being. It is a superficies. It is not even the whole of our mentality. I would love to, yes. Just always remind me. And as Kirti says, holler. This computer is very eager to go to the next page. Behind it, much vaster than it, that is the superficial mental awareness, there is a subliminal or subconscient mind, which is the greater part of ourselves and contains heights and profundities which no man has yet measured or fathomed. This knowledge gives us a starting point for the true science of force and its workings. It delivers us definitely from circumscription by the material and from the illusion of the obvious. Now, I'm going to jump to where we need to go next. We may go farther. When we speak of subconscious mind, we should mean by the phrase a thing not different from the outer mentality, but only acting below the surface, unknown to the waking man, unknown to our mental awareness, but still functioning like it. In the same sense, if perhaps with a deeper plunge and a larger scope, but the phenomena of the subliminal self far exceeds the limits of any such definition. It includes an action not only immensely superior in capacity, but quite different in kind from what we know as mentality in our waking self. We have therefore a right to suppose that there is a superconscient in us as well as a subconscient. A range of conscious faculties and therefore an organization of consciousness which rise high above that psychological stratum to which we give the name of mentality. And since the subliminal self in us thus rises in superconscience above mentality, may it not also sink in subconscience below mentality? Are there not in us and in the world forms of consciousness which are submental, to which we can give the name of vital and physical consciousness? So we had come to this point in our explorations last time and the time before, when we said that it is necessary to begin to think about physical consciousness, vital consciousness, mental consciousness, spiritual consciousness, not only in us, but as principles in existence. Because if we observe nature in the terms that we have been considering all of the different phyla and all of the different periods in the evolution of life, And if we consider those myriad forms of cognitive existence functioning constantly, far beyond our range of perception at any time, we can become aware of an infinitude of consciousness surrounding the globe, the biosphere, of which we are current momentary fragments. And so we begin through this study to acquire an appreciation of a conscious world that exists at many different levels of evolution. And we have learned that at different periods of evolution, different levels of consciousness have predominated. And there has been a progressive emergence of higher levels of consciousness with respect to structure and complexity. The higher the level of structure and complexity, the more diverse and individualized the consciousness of the species in its, as can be perceived in its behavior. And so we get a perception then that what is evolving is consciousness. It is also structure, and it is also organism. And so the physical, the vital, and the mental are co-evolutionary dimensions of what I have referred to as the threefold complex. When we say consciousness evolves, we mean structure evolves. And when we say structure evolves, we mean consciousness evolves, because we have identified life itself as a cognitive phenomenon. Every species at every moment is acting from, each individual of every species is acting from its center in relation to its environment, creating itself and creating its environment. According to its type, which is an accumulation of various characteristics that have evolved selectively. Now, I want to jump a little bit further ahead. Page 88 in my book. Now, we need to keep in mind that what Sri Aurobindo is discussing here is two principles, force and consciousness, both of which we perceive. Everyone agrees that force is a reality of the universe, and if we go all the way back to our first resource, who was Spencer. According to Spencer, everything that has happened and happens and will happen is just a process of force diversifying, differentiating, unifying, and so on. And he can describe all of existence in that way. But what right have we to assume consciousness as the just description for this force? Sri Aurobindo would like to consider force in existence equal to consciousness, chit shakti, as the fundamental principle of existence. So he's moving in that direction. For consciousness implies some kind of intelligence, purposefulness, self-knowledge, even though they may not take the forms habitual to our mentality. One of the things that Darwin pointed out very effectively and successfully, and all subsequent Neo-Darwinians continue to elaborate, is that nature works for a purpose. Nature is intelligent. She designs the most incredible, unbelievable apparatuses for consciousness, far beyond the scope of any engineering feats that human beings have performed. And they work. And they work so well that she selects them to sustain themselves over millennia. They continue to work, generation after generation after generation, these artifices of nature. And she does very little which is not for a purpose. This is the theme of Darwinian thinking. And you will find it in the most hard-nosed ultra-Darwinians of today. Nature is the blind watchmaker. We can backward engineer everything that nature does and see for what purpose each thing has evolved in relation to all the other things that support it. We can backward engineer what nature does, and we can dream up ways to imitate her sometimes. No, they absolutely do not leave that out.
They say it's purposeful.
And beautiful. And amazing. And intelligent.
Maybe beautiful is also a purpose. Maybe
yeah. So you're anticipating as usual. Because you already know everything. And so do all the rest of us. But we're patiently working through the process.
For whatever reason it may be, I want to, and you're, but you're beautiful in this way, this way, this way.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go forward here. I have a lot of material to cover. We see, for instance, in the animal, operations of a perfect purposefulness and an exact, indeed a scientifically minute knowledge which are quite beyond the capacities of the animal mentality, and which man himself can only acquire by long culture and education, and even then uses with a much less sure rapidity. You can read in Daniel Dennett, and I will do this next time, passages which are almost identical to this. We are entitled to see in this general fact the proof of a conscious force at work in the animal and the insect, which is more intelligent, more purposeful, more aware of its intention, its ends, its means, its conditions, than the highest mentality yet manifested in any individual form on earth. That is a bold statement by a mystic. And in the operations of inanimate nature, the material world, the material mind, we find the same pervading characteristic of a supreme hidden intelligence, hidden in the modes of its own workings. And so today we have huge volumes of philosophy by physicists explaining something called the anthropic principle, which we will not go into in this class. But basically what it says is, if the universe had been composed of any other elements than it is composed of, and if it had evolved in any less amount of time than it has evolved, and if our solar system was in any way different with respect to its size and power and age than it is now, carbon-based life could not exist. And if carbon-based life did not exist and had not evolved within the time frame that it has evolved, we would not be able to understand the principle of relativity. The mind would not exist if the universe were not exactly as it is. So, mind, the idea that the principle of mind is ever present, was one of the things that Erwin Schrödinger wrote his last book about in 1944. The first full edition of The Life Divine was published in 1940. And by 1944, Sri Aurobindo was already getting nominations for the Nobel Prize. This thought has pervaded evolutionary science since the beginning. And so Schrödinger, who was a physicist, went into biology in the 30s and 40s, and he came to the conclusion that mind was by no means an exclusively human phenomenon of the last few thousand years, that it would be meaningless to think that that's what mind is. So,
who's he quoting
here? Sri Aurobindo is above acknowledging his sources. Unfortunately. Probably Darwin. But maybe Haeckel. He read a lot of Haeckel.
I think it's
maybe it is, yeah. For Sri Aurobindo, you know, it's the Vedic or scientific, what's the difference? Okay, so I want to just jump down a little bit to this last paragraph before going to where we really need to go. For the rest, it is impossible to ignore the drive of set purpose, the guidance of apparent blind tendency, the blind watchmaker, the sure eventual or immediate coming to the target sought, which characterize the operations of world force in the animal, in the plant, in inanimate things. So long as matter was alpha and omega to the scientific mind, the reluctance to admit intelligence as the mother of intelligence was an honest scruple.
What's that?
Yeah, I'll jump to this in a moment. This is called the ex nihilo argument, that from nothing, nothing can come. So from matter, intelligence cannot come. But it was an honest scruple when people believed that intelligence was a recent phenomenon belonging only to human beings, and everything else in the universe was mechanical. But now it is no more than an outworn paradox to affirm the emergence of human consciousness, intelligence, and mastery out of an unintelligent, blindly driving unconsciousness in which no form or substance of them previously existed. Man's consciousness can be nothing else than a form of nature's consciousness. It is there in other involved forms below mind. It emerges in mind. It shall ascend into yet superior forms beyond mind. For the force that builds the worlds is a conscious force. The existence which manifests itself in them is conscious being and a perfect emergence of its potentialities in form is the sole object which we can rationally conceive for its manifestation of this world of forms. Now, the question that we ended with last time was, do we need anything more than this? Because both philosophy and science give us this today. This knowledge, this understanding of evolution, this understanding of existence is given. And so on the basis of this, Bergson says in 1907, the next step in evolution must be the emergence of an intuitive consciousness, something higher than the mind, something supra-rational, which enables us to know directly all of that which we speak about rationally. Since it's all conscious being, and we are an evolving form of conscious being, doesn't it make sense that our next step in evolution will be beyond rational mind and will be one with time? We will endure with the being of beings instead of abstracting from our experience a stable formula of beings and processes. The rational mind has been recognized to have limits. But there is a sense of oneness, an intuition of oneness, which leads philosophers and scientists to believe that a higher kind of consciousness is most likely to emerge. And so Sri Aurobindo will say a little bit farther along, the spiritual urge in human beings is an indication of that. But also another indication of that are ideals such as democracy. Where have we ever seen democracy in action? Where have we ever seen universal education in action in the world? And yet we conceive of these ideals as being within the range of human potential. We believe that things like democracy and universal education and universal prosperity and health are possible for the human being to realize. Where do these ideas come from? They certainly don't come from our experience.
Exactly. Isn't the golden age of Greece an experience by which we say our democracy and so on?
There have been many historical experiments with the idea of democracy. But what about the idea of democracy? Where do we get that from? So this is a course in philosophy. And what we have been trying to do for the last few weeks is think philosophically on the basis of what we know about existence scientifically, about the evolution of the human mind, which we've been discussing for a couple of weeks. What can we infer regarding the nature of reality? What can we infer with regard to our own behavior in relation to others? How is meaning, the meaning of things, enhanced by this understanding of evolution? Does it matter to us? What is real and what is an illusion? Is democracy real, or is it just another one of our stupid imaginations which we are never going to realize? Are we going to just keep on having terrorist attacks? And are we going to just continue the gap between the rich and the poor? And are we going to simply pollute the planet and extinguish ourselves? Yes, all of these things are quite likely. In fact, there is very little reason, if you ask me, to believe that we're not going to do any of those things. We may evolve a higher mind which is capable of a more direct intuition. And then we may be able to act more for the betterment of ourselves and the world, just as we have been trying to act for the betterment of ourselves, if not the world, since we became ethical. But beyond that, what? Is that any guarantee? The question that that we asked last time and that we just asked tonight, Sri Aurobindo also asked for the same reasons at the same point in his thinking.
What kind of what all the texts are saying is that there is a world force and there is a consciousness force which is guiding also, then for me, looking at all the other reflections, then he must surrender to it too.
Well, you're speaking from a point of view of faith. And so you would say, if we need anything more than what we've already come to, we need faith.
No, also logical subsequence would be. It's not only, it's also a logical thing when there's a conscious force who's guiding all, then it's good to follow it.
So far, Sri Aurobindo has not said to us that there is a conscious force guiding all. He has said that there is a conscious force in existence that is evolving. So you have jumped from our current status to that status towards which we are inquiring at this point in this chapter. So the questions that we're asking are primarily stated in this chapter, Man and the Evolution. The prerequisites for this chapter are in that earlier chapter, Conscious Force. And the subsequent chapter is the evolution of the spiritual man. So I'll jump into that one very briefly. But in this chapter, I want to look at this question. All these are conclusions that can be arrived at even from the observation of the outward phenomena of nature's progression. All these things that we have said so far in this course, and all of the things which Sri Aurobindo has said in this chapter, which summarize what we have said in this course, not deliberately, by the way, I came to this chapter at the same time that you did in this course. I had not predetermined that we would come to this point. I began with Darwin. So, I believe this statement is true. We can arrive at all of these conclusions with the help of Bergson and Lorenz and various neo-Darwinians and Darwin himself. But there is the other, the invisible factor. The invisible factor. And I'm not going to dwell on this particular formulation. I want to go to another formulation a little bit ahead, where he... actually there is something of interest on this page. Something of interest and something very frightening.
Frightening?
Yeah. It is not an impossibility that man should aid nature consciously also in his own spiritual and physical evolution and transformation. The urge to it is already there and partly effective, though still incompletely understood and accepted by the surface mentality. What he's referring to is it has to be noted that the human mind has already shown a capacity to aid nature in the evolution of new types of plant and animal. It has created new forms of its environment, developed by knowledge and discipline considerable changes in its own mentality. And so when I did a short course on evolution a couple of years back, I gave a handout regarding bioengineering and artificial intelligence. And there is a very large, powerful contingent of scientists in the world today who believe that they can do exactly what Sri Aurobindo is suggesting technologically. Yes, human intelligence, extension of the lifespan of human beings, elimination of disease through genetic engineering. And many of the scientists who were involved in the nuclear bomb project are believers that their knowledge will eventually liberate humanity from all of its ills. And that the second coming of Christ is about technology. And that all of this secret society of most enlightened scientists has the responsibility. Not only is Crick a member of this society, but he is a strong believer that the Human Genome Project has the potential to lead to human perfectibility. And they are highly inspired by this belief. And they are very well paid by the government to pursue its realization.
American scientists?
Pardon me?
American scientists?
All over the all it's the scientific community. So there are those who believe that the evolution of the human beyond mentality is not only possible, it's inevitable, but not for the same reasons that Sri Aurobindo says it's inevitable. They believe it's inevitable because we are now in control.
Of what?
Of matter. Matter, life, mind. No, but there's a belief, you know, so there's a faith. You know, there's a faith among scientists which is at least equal to the faith among mystics. So then I want to jump to this idea, which Sri Aurobindo, of course, says that our urge to realize a higher divine intuition and to realize our oneness with all of nature and to achieve cosmic consciousness as a stepping stone to supermind is inevitable because supermind is the origin of existence. And its evolution of itself through ascending forms must eventually arrive at a supramental form. So we will read that argument now, Let's see, where is this? 853, which, who knows what that's going to be in that book. So it is throughout evolutionary nature. Let's try that here.
The difference is 877 and 844 in the book.
Excuse me?
The difference here is 877 and in my book it's 844.
33. Now, why does that not want to? Yes, that's it. So it is throughout evolutionary nature. Let's just take this "so it is" as referring to what we now know. Matter could not have become animate if the principle of life had not been there constituting matter, constituting matter, making matter, and emerging as a phenomenon of life in matter. Life in matter could not have begun to feel, perceive, think, reason, if the principle of mind had not been there behind life and substance, constituting it as its field of operation and emergent in the phenomenon of a thinking life and body. So it was always there, but it became emergent in the human mind. So too, spirituality emerging in mind is the sign of a power which itself has founded and constituted life, mind, and body, and is now emerging as a spiritual being in a living and thinking body. A being with spiritual consciousness in a mental, vital, physical, human complex. Now, how does he get to this point? How far this emergence will go, whether it will become dominant and transform its instrument, is a subsequent question. So don't ask that one yet. Try and stay on this one. But what is necessary first to posit? So here Sri Aurobindo says, yes, it is necessary to posit something more than what we have already learned. Is the existence of spirit as something else than mind, and greater than mind? Spirituality as something other than mentality, and the spiritual being, therefore, as something distinct from the mental being. Spirit is a final evolutionary emergence because it is the original involutionary element. And factor. In the constitution of existence, there is the material factor, the vital factor, the mental factor, concealed in force, consciousness force, and another factor, spirit, different from those factors, a fourth principle. Evolution is an inverse action of the involution. What is an ultimate and last derivation in the involution is the first to appear in the evolution. No, let's Sri Aurobindo do it. What was original and primal in the involution is in the evolution the last and supreme emergence.
But did Sri Aurobindo give a proof of that? For example, I'm thinking about the Atlantis, you know, civilization. But it's supposed that supermind existed before.
He never has said that it existed before.
This is what I understood.
He has never said that it existed before. And even in the Vedic times, the Vedic rishis only had a touch. Through the overmind. So, Sri Aurobindo's goal was to demonstrate that the supermind could manifest through the overmind in the body.
Through the overmind.
First, the overmind channel had to be created because it is the lower range of the supermind. In the chapter which follows this, called The Evolution of the Spiritual Man, Sri Aurobindo makes emphatically clear that the evolution of a supramental being is so different from the evolution of a mental being, even at its very highest, that it's unimaginable. So he conceived of the evolution of a new type of being. Absolutely new and different. But he also conceived of the human as a transitional vehicle, like all those other millions of transitional vehicles that we have been observing in our course. Because one thing that our mind has been capable of here at moments is looking at, envisioning the world of life as an ever-changing, never-stable, constantly diversifying energy of consciousness in evolution. Every form, every species has become extinct up till now, but it hasn't stopped. The process hasn't stopped. 99.9% of all species that have ever existed are extinct. And many more are becoming extinct as we speak. But that doesn't stop the movement. The perception of change, of process, is something that the rational mind has a hard time with, because it tends to zero in upon something which has consistency, constancy, stability, and it calls that the thing which it knows, which exists, which it isn't. What actually exists is a constantly changing evolutionary field. So the human being right now, as we speak, is changing, is evolving. Everything is in motion. And so then what is it that is in motion? So we look out over this vast field of human creation and we see power, truth, beauty, harmony, skill, utility. We look at all the different species that we can envision in our expanded imagination, and we can see that there are vital principles that manifest in extraordinarily diverse forms of behavior in many species. The vital force, consciousness in its vital formation, has explored not only through species that now exist, but through eons of species that have led up to now. All of its possible relationships of power and possession and consumption and formation and beauty and intelligence, until the human being has come along amalgamating the benefits of all of those eons of beauty and power and intelligence and utility. And yet, do we see anything like ultimate beauty or power or intelligence anywhere in manifestation? What we see, what we can see in our most inspired moments, is indications of a possibility of a greater power and intelligence and beauty and harmony and perfection. And even that is barely a glimpse of what has been already recognized by philosophers and poets for centuries as a higher mind intuition. Sri Aurobindo is reaching towards a manifestation in life of an absolutely divine degree of power and beauty and intelligence and harmony and perfection. So far beyond the human that we can hardly even glimpse its tail, which is what Sri Aurobindo was trying to pull down through Savitri.
It's supposed to take place in Aurobindo, no?
Oh, God only knows. But in this chapter, in this next chapter on the evolution of the spiritual man, he describes in detail what he is able to grasp as the ultimate degree of intuitive mind, which is a marvelous improvement on what we now are capable of. And then he says, but this won't change anything.
This won't change. Man will still be bad as he is now, not
yeah.
the next.
And the terrorists will still be there, and the rich and the poor division will still be there. But this marvelous intuitive mind that Bergson intuited is a step on the way. But he says, the power of the Gnostic being is not that. The power of the Gnostic being, the supramental being, is not the intuitive mind. Not even the most intuitivized intuitive mind. Okay. It's still something else, and it's not mind at all.
Yeah.
It's embodied power. Well, not the supramental body, but I'm afraid you'll have to wait a few more lifetimes for that one, because Sri Aurobindo also plugs in here into this philosophy of supramental evolution, the idea that not only is there a continuity from birth to birth in matter, life, and mind, but there's a continuity of supramental selfhood. There is an evolving soul that is carrying along this evolving body. And so I believe what he's suggesting is that if we can make that contact now in this body, that we can more effectively manifest that future body. But he also says another possibility is that the human being will just keep on going in the same way that nature has been going, grabbing a little bit, imposing it on what's lower, and the intuitive mind can intuitivize the regular mind and life and body over a long period of time once it's been realized. But Sri Aurobindo sort of laid down the law here. He said that's no more worth the trouble, because people have been reaching through the intuitive mind and trying to bring it down into the ordinary mind already for a long time. And the only way things are really going to definitively change in the manifestation is for the supermind itself to manifest in its own principle, which so far has been so involved that all it could manage to do up until now is us, and it's not that great.
Well, that's what I thought. Isn't that what he says here in Man and Evolution, that we'll reach our peak, whether we can, you know, do some of the things you just said there, but then the next step, we're not the next step.
Yep.
We're not going to come the next
step. So just to close this discussion, we're not the next step, no. We're the last previous step. So on the basis of this idea, Sri Aurobindo concludes that it is necessary for us to assume and to posit another principle. From what the human mind has been able to understand about evolution up until now, we can get as far as we have gotten. And he says the urge to spirituality and a spiritual transformation and an intuitivized being is the sign of a further possibility which is as yet hardly even imaginable. But the sign itself, he says, is proof enough that that farther than imaginable was there from the beginning. And so what is that? Then he says that from our spiritual experience, referring to himself primarily and a few other privileged souls, and from our philosophical understanding, we can posit this as the nature of existence, this more than matter, life, and mind. We can posit an absolute. And we must, says Sri Aurobindo, to fully explain evolution and the quandary of the human being, we must posit the absolute. Now, if you remember back in the first handout that I gave you, Spencer also posited an absolute. But he said, this is the last thing we will ever know anything about, and anyway, it doesn't matter, because all of existence flows from it, and it does a perfectly good job on its own. And then Darwin jumped into the picture and said, no, forget about the absolute. We have matter, life, and mind are evolving, and nature is able to figure out everything. And he was right. Nature has suddenly figured out what's more than itself. It has come to this resonance with the Absolute that promises another evolution, another speciation, based upon other principles than nature has so far had at her disposal. So let me just, there's a chapter in the Life Divine called The Four Aims of Existence. And they are not four different aims. This is not only the definition of the Absolute, but it's also the definition of what Sri Aurobindo means by integral reality, integral spirituality. And it requires that there be an absolute consciousness, a cosmic consciousness, which is the plane of first principles and divine beings, and an individual consciousness which is able to understand, know, interface with the cosmic and the absolute, and then it becomes possible an integral manifestation of all the planes. But the one that I want to look at is just the plane of the absolute. And this is on page 668 by the old dispensation. In the new dispensation, let's see what it is. The aim of life, four theories of existence, 658. First, we affirm an absolute. As the origin and support and secret reality of all things. The absolute reality. That means absolute truth, power, beauty, harmony, divine self-being. Is indefinable and ineffable by mental thought and mental language. It is self-existent, the totality. It is not other than this. It is all of this, seen and unseen. Self-existent and self-evident to itself. As all absolutes are self-evident. But our mental affirmatives and negatives, whether taken separatively or together, cannot limit or define it. But at the same time, there is a spiritual consciousness, a spiritual knowledge, a knowledge by identity, not abstract, theoretical, metaphorical, a knowledge by identity which can seize the reality in its fundamental aspects and its manifested powers and figures. all that is comes within this description.
Knowledge by identity.
Myself. I am. I am power. I am time. I am space. I am the unfolding. And in that unfolding is everything. Spiritually perceived, not manifested. Everything that is manifested is within that, is a vibration of that. But nothing that is manifested is entirely that. And that is stillness, absolute. Peace absolute, power absolute, knowledge absolute, truth absolute, beauty absolute, delight absolute. All that is comes within this description, and if seen by this knowledge in its own truth, or its occult meaning, can be regarded as an expression of the reality and itself a reality. That is to say, the human being sitting here in this room is itself a reality as an expression of that reality. This manifested reality is self-existent in these fundamental aspects. For all the basic realities are a bringing out of something that is eternal and inherently true in the absolute. Including our little intellectual attempt to understand reality.
Can I make an announcement?
Sure.
Darwin's fellow was Wallace, the guy who wrote
Wallace.
In the December issue of the National Geographic, there is a large article on Wallace.
Yeah.
Who he was, what he did, this Wallace line saying that these creatures, these plants, are only on this side, and not on the other side, and of course, vice versa.
Wallace was a mystic.
He was,
and Wallace published the theory of natural selection before Darwin did, but he recognized Darwin as the one who explained it most fully, and so they had an agreement that Darwin would publish the full theory and get the credit for it. But Wallace was also a monist, and he was very much in the school of Haeckel, this kind of monistic evolutionary oneness. But he understood perfectly well that evolutionary oneness was working through natural selection. It wasn't something outside.
It also goes into mundane aspects, how he supported himself. He had somebody in England who bought his large collections of beauties, etc., allowed him to support himself. And he and Darwin were good friends.
Here's a statement of Sri Aurobindo that Wallace would love. We can no longer suppose that God or some demiurge has manufactured each genus and species ready-made in body and in consciousness, and left the matter there, having looked upon his work and seen that it was good. It has become evident that a secretly conscious or an inconscient energy of creation has effected the transition from principle to principle. Only something involved in existence itself, which is to say, only existence itself has done this. not something else. Sorry, as usual, to go over.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you very much.